if you're not sticking up for yourself in terms of discrimination, sexism, harassment, mistreatment of any sort, I want there to be a stigma around being silent. As of right now, the world that we still in, there's kind of this stigma of speaking out. That's why I called the book Troublemaker. It's kind of tongue in cheek in that regard. You know, the minute that you stick up for yourself, for other people, you're called a troublemaker.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Hi, my name's Lisa Cornwell, and I recently wrote a book called Troublemaker. Welcome to Sylvia and Me.
Lisa, thank you so much for being a guest today and having a conversation, because you didn't just write a book called Troublemaker. We have, it's a memoir of sexism, retaliation, and the fight that they didn't see coming. I love it.
Yeah.
I want to do a couple of things first before we really get into it, because I want to lay the background of who you are, your personality. And one of the things is that the foreword to the book is written by somebody that people may know, Hillary Rodham Clinton. And in it, she says, thankfully, gutsy women are still at it the world over, especially in the U.S. after the repeal of Roe v. Wade. Lisa Cornwell is one of them. And there was also in the book jacket, at the very beginning, it talks about you as a freshman in college. You saw a man hit a woman in the face with a closed fist while a paralyzed crowd, of course, stood and watched. You then took matters into your own hands, and with a 3-iron from your golf bag, you got him to stop. So one of the things is that you were an on-air reporter and host for the Golf Channel. You worked there for almost 7 years. Your last day was December 31st, 2020. On January 1st, 2021, you tweeted, "The first day in 7 years, I'm not in a contract with Golf Channel, and I'm free to speak up for the many women who've been marginalized, belittled, berated, and treated like second-class citizens, including me. The days of it being swept under the rug are over. Hashtag more to come." Can you tell us why you wrote that Twitter note? I think we need to back up a little to the beginning, which is the little boys' club of the sports media. So why don't you take it? Why did you write that Twitter?
Well, as you well know, the Boys Club exists more than, unfortunately, just the sports media.
Yes,
it really exists in every single walk of life, whether it's something to do with a job or not. So that's first and foremost. And look, I will say this, I'll preface it. I grew up an athlete, and some of my best friends are guys. And so I was part of a different boys club. I was part of like the competitive boys club, but not this boys club that really tries to stymie women and different groups of people, whether you want to say minorities or marginalized groups, whatever. But I wrote that tweet specifically as a warning signal. Well, probably two things. As a warning signal, I wanted to let folks know that my job was finished at Golf Channel, which I had basically tweeted a goodbye tweet 2 weeks prior than that. That was just very, you know, very emotional and thank you in that regard. And so I let people know that my time at Golf Channel was coming to an end. So that was the goodbye message in mid-December. January 1, I could send the real message, which was I didn't leave on my own merits. I got pushed out. And you're talking about somebody who worked for a network in a sport that I had a great amount of history in, a long background of success as a competitive golfer. And so not only these years of trying to work my way up as broadcaster, but I had credibility in the sport because I played it at a pretty high level. So I wanted to let folks know that there was more to this story than the goodbye tweet and the sympathetic Lisa that sent the message in mid-December, because I was emotional about leaving. There were parts of my job, obviously, that I really loved. There were people in the game that I loved. I didn't want to leave those aspects of it. However, the political elements of the job led to my dismissal, and it had been going on for quite some time. And so that's why this book was necessary, to fully tell the story, because you've read the book. And as you know, there were a lot of different dominoes that didn't fall all together. But once you read the book, they fall succinctly together. You can understand why this was a story that I needed to tell and wanted to tell, and hopefully will help some women along the way.
Well, I'd like to go back specifically to 2018, I believe it was. It had to do with one of the professional golfers and a manufacturer. It was probably not the first time you got some pushback from one of your male colleagues, but can you tell us that story? Because I think it's one that resonates with so many people.
Yeah, and I want to say this, first of all, because I'm sure a lot of people listening to this are not golfers. They may Right. not even really be into sports. As Hillary points out in her foreword that was so wonderfully done, this is not a sports book. I just reference golf, and I reference the sport of golf, and as you talked about, the manufacturer, because that was my job. You could translate it however. I mean, this could be a job in a restaurant, and you just substitute some of the stories and titles, and it would relate to everybody. So the story specifically that you're talking about, keep in mind, when this happened, we had already filed our first of what ended up being two charges against Golf Channel, separate charges with the EEOC, which we filed the first one after I got demoted and the second one after my contract wasn't renewed. So the story with Mizuno, the manufacturer, happened while the first EEOC charge had already been filed. And we were roughly 4 to 5 months in the process of that and going back and forth with the investigator. So it was a little surprising, you would think. However, knowing the parties at play, it's not surprising. Because when people have agendas and they're emotionally involved in a negative way, those emotions tend to come out, which is what happened with Mizuno. So basically, the gist of the story, a professional golfer who I know well, and I had heard the story directly from her, had asked for some golf clubs from a manufacturer. And this is a very common ask in professional golf, professional sports, really. It'd be like a football player asking for gloves. You know, these are just common items. To the everyday consumer, they're expensive, but to golfers, they're just part of it. And she's an Asian woman, Chinese woman who lives here in the States playing. And he basically just snubbed her off. Now, keep in mind, she's one of the top ranked players on tour. And he just repeatedly said, "We can't get you what you need. You need to go elsewhere." So she ended up going through her coach to a local store and buying the golf clubs on her own and having her club builder fit them to her specifications. So I knew the story. After the first round, she was leading, had a couple of bogeys coming in, but she was still very close to the lead. So I was doing the live interviews for the tournament that week. And I made a comment off the top. I said, "Well, I bet the Mizuno Tour rep who made you pay for these clubs is regretting that decision right now." And then I went right into my question about something else, but I wanted to drive home the point that they had said no to her, which, first of all, would never, ever, ever happen in men's golf. It would never happen. It doesn't matter. European Tour, Korn Ferry, PGA Tour, it would never happen. But it has happened quite often in the women's game. So I wanted to point out the inequality that existed there. It was a small statement, but it was a very clear statement as to what had happened to this player. And there was a lot of social media backlash and a lot of support for my, because I tweeted about it too, a lot of support from the question and for the tweet, for publicly finally calling these people out. What those of us who are close to the sport know that it exists quite often. So there was backlash. Long story short, my boss, who again, it's a hard story to explain because we get into nepotism and all these things. But my direct boss was married or is married to the executive producer of the network. So he had nepotism at play. And he ended up calling me over this issue. I tried to talk to him reasonably about it. He cussed me out on the phone. And when I refused to talk to him after his outburst, he sent me home from the tournament rather than handling it in a professional manner, the way that any other person would have done, any other reasonable person, I will say.
It was like putting you in timeout.
It was more than that. I mean, wow. I got sent home from California. Yeah. And I had already, keep in mind, I had already been demoted. And so, like I said, the EEOC case had been filed. And this is a man who was at the center of the controversy. And now all of a sudden, he's taking control of the situation just based on emotions. And you can see what happens as you read the book and watch the story unfold.
So
there.
I want to go back to, as you said, you had already filed a claim with the EEOC, which we'll get into exactly what they can and can't do and what the outcome of that was. But you're talking about a toxic work environment. You're being berated by your boss and you're being sent home. As you said, it wasn't a question of getting in your car and going home. You got how to get on a flight and go home. When did it start? When did the atmosphere and the environment at your workplace start to become so untenable that you filed your first claim?
Well, I will say anyone who has read the Washington Post article. So after I spoke out and I put that tweet out that you mentioned, the Washington Post got wind of it and Ben Strauss did an investigative report on the Golf Channel. So in his article, he ended up talking to 19 women, myself included, that really told the full story of the systemic culture that has existed at Golf Channel from day one and didn't get any better when Comcast, NBC, Universal took it over. There were minor things that happened in the beginning. You know, you always have employees, I think, in a big company that you just, for whatever reason, don't seem to get along with. That's the unfortunate part of just doing business, I guess. Right. And that's okay. But it's when these people have the ability to get in the ear of the bigger bosses and control your assignments or affect your on-air work or control who works with whom, that it really starts to show itself in a different way. So chapter 13 in my book is called Chambly, Brandel Chambly, the lead analyst at Golf Channel, who is very toxic. He's known as one of those people who likes to be very controversial, and he'll say some outlandish things on air. And they kind of like it, I guess, because it stirs things up. It's kind of like watching Judge Judy. You know, yeah. Judge Judy will just say things to people, and people watch because, yeah, they like that. That's sensationalism. You know, that's made for TV magic. But when you work with those people behind the scenes, and they carry that same attitude over off camera that they have on camera, that's when things start to get a little bit different. Brandel had a lot of control and still does, quite honestly, at the network. He's very influential in the higher ups with them. And I would say that early on, he's one of the people that I probably had the controversy with the most. I mean, I got along with everybody I worked with. That's what's interesting about this story. You feel like you're speaking about the whole network, and that's not true. I'm speaking about, you know, 3% of the network or 2% of the network, however it boils down mathematically. But the real problems for me happened when our executive producer, Molly Solomon, who is still the executive producer today, brought her husband in as an SVP to oversee the on-air talent. So they're basically the two of them working in tandem, but they have to give him a senior vice president role. So he's not reporting directly to his wife. It was basically a workaround. But here's the problem. When you get in bad graces with her husband, who else are you getting in bad graces with? You're getting in bad graces with her. So when her husband came on board as the head of news operations everything about my job changed. It was fine before then. I mean, there were minor conflicts, but he took it to a different level because, I mean, quite frankly, I don't think that he can handle strong, powerful women who have their own voice.
Who stand up for themselves when they see something isn't right and won't be berated for something. You know, when you're working, there are times when you could do something wrong, but as a supervisor, you should be able to explain to that person what they did wrong, how they can fix it, and go on. And what you have done is really ignite a voice where women can say, it's okay, I'm going to stand up for myself. Or as what happened, once you put that tweet out, open my mouth and say that, oh, wow, you know what? That happened to me. Oh, it didn't just happen to me. It happened to you, and it happened to you, and it happened to you. And I think that is really the biggest thing that has come out of somebody like you, not only writing the book, but starting it off with that tweet. Can you describe what you felt after getting some reaction to that tweet? Because I know you probably had an enormous amount of negativity in there too, because as you said, you know, you had a big boys club behind the Golf Channel. But were you surprised by a lot of the response that you received?
I was surprised, honestly, that it wasn't more negative. I really was, because you know how social media works these days. That tweet, if you go through and read the comments, 90%, probably more, were very positive and supportive. I have no doubt not everybody liked me on TV. That's never going to happen. But I do think that the people who watch Golf Channel knew that I had an extensive knowledge of the game. And I think that they respected me for that. So for the network to get rid of me the way that they did and just claim that it was budget, I wouldn't have been the person that you got rid of, really. I mean, it was a very uplifting moment, I think, for me. And it lasted for quite some time. I had a lot of folks not only reach out publicly on social media, but privately too. Whether it was through direct messages or coworkers, former coworkers, people from other industries, it was overwhelmingly positive. And so it really kind of gave me fuel to keep going through this whole process. And that's when we filed a couple months later the second charge against Golf Channel with the EEOC, and that was for the non-renewal of the contract. I just wanted these, bullets to keep coming. I didn't want just one shot at them and then I go away, because that's what usually happens. Actually, what usually happens is the first bullet doesn't even come along. And look, yeah. I understand why. I get it, because look, I'm living proof that retaliation is real. If anybody wonders about that, or they're questioning, or they're fearful of it, I'm always the first to tell people, look, if they can retaliate against me, they can retaliate against anybody. So I always want to put that out there as fair warning. But I will say this, one of the many reasons that I did want to write this book was to encourage more people that it's worth it. It's worth it to go through it. You know, look, I'm not making as much money as I did when I worked at Golf Channel. I don't have the exposure. I don't have the connection as much to the game. I'm still connected, but I'm a lot happier. I can tell you that. I went into work every day, every single day, wondering what's going to happen today. What am I going to have to deal with today? Or whose story am I going to have to listen to today who's also been put through the ringer? Because it wasn't just my issues that happened. I mean, I tell the story in the book about the young woman in her 20s who was like a little sister to me, who got told by a veteran male employee in his 50s, screaming at her, cussing her out, and then wanted to top it off with telling her that any trained monkey could do her job. I mean, I can't even, first of all, I can't, not only can I not imagine saying that to somebody, that those words aren't even in my vocabulary. But this person not only got away with it, went right back to work. There was no suspension. They initially weren't even going to make him apologize until a small group of us kept going to Molly Solomon and saying, look, you have to make him at least apologize. She's on the verge of hiring a lawyer. I wish she would have hired a lawyer, because that's how you get them to pay attention. You know, these partial apologies don't mean anything. And if they did, then this behavior would stop. This wasn't the first time that he had done it. The reason that he kept doing it was because he kept getting away with it. And so, you know, I look at the people in charge. It's really not that difficult. If good people are running the place, people who care about right versus wrong. I mean, we learned that in kindergarten. I learned right versus wrong from my parents at home, probably when I was 3 or 4 years old. I don't get it. I don't understand it. But a lot of folks have gotten away with it for so long. It's just ingrained in them. And that's why those words are not overused. Systemic culture is a real thing.
Yes, it is. And the, you know, one of the points is, as women, we've grown up really not to retaliate, because then we're looked at as being coarse and crude, and who are we? I mean, we're supposed to be sweet and gentle and so on.
And grateful. And, we should be grateful.
Oh, grateful.
Right, yeah.
And and as you said, no, you're not making as much money. You don't have, but you're happier. You know, going to work and being berated on a regular basis is not something that should be allowed. And yet it is, to such a large extent. And it's only been recently that women have had the courage to come out and let their voice be heard. And it's not easy, because if you need that income coming in, if you're supporting a family, it's beyond difficult to stand up for yourself and say, you know, okay, fine, I'll be fired. You know, who cares? I can get something else. And one of the points is that your bosses, you went to HR was a woman. You went to somebody else was a woman. And yet these women you went to did not help you. In fact, they kind of stirred the pot somewhat by going behind your back in a couple of instances and making things worse. A lot of these women do it because they're afraid of their own jobs.
I would say that there's a cold place in hell for those women.
Thank you.
And I say that loudly. And I mean that. I have learned, Sylvia, through this process, that the notion of sisterhood is one of the most disappointing realizations of my life. And you mentioned it. I work in a very male-dominated business. The brotherhood that exists is incredible. I mean, they stick together. They stick up for each other. I tell the story in the book about that group of guys, one of whom I used to work with, and the social media attacks that they kept coming at, calling me drunk, calling me crazy, calling all these things. And they were all liking these, you know, all liking these posts. And that's what they do. They band together and stick together. It's not always in that toxic way, but my point is they stick together. I relate it to the Black community a lot. I mean, you think of the social movement from the African American community that we have witnessed in this country the last 60 years. And I've talked to a lot of my Black friends about this. They're not 100% unified, but they're a heck of a lot more unified than women. You know, it could be 95%, and you're looking at women. I mean, I would say 40%. It is so frustrating to me, because I'm the first person with a woman to go stand up for her. I mean, I will go into battle. I will do whatever I can to make it better, even if it runs the risk of hurting me. I just don't see that from other women. I see it from some, but not from a lot. And women are so, they're careful, they're worried, and I get it. But at some point, we have to advance each other and lift each other up, not knock each other down. There's a great book that I would recommend to all your viewers, the authority gap. It is a fantastic, well-researched, well-documented study of not only the difference between women and men, but how women for so long have been trained to break each other down through this whole queen bee scenario. So it's a great read, but I certainly experienced it and I haven't given up on it.
Well,
but it's definitely
it's
definitely something that I want to continue to highlight and talk about because it has to get better. We have to be better at this. We have to. I've only gotten a small number of 1-star ratings on my book. Of course, none of them leave a review. They just rate it. But one of those people who left a 1-star review, I don't know if she knows that I could see her name. I worked with her at Golf Channel. And it just amazes me that a woman would read this book, or even if she hasn't read this book, would still want to put a 1-star review on it, basically saying that these things don't exist. I'll talk to her one day because I'll make a point to find her out. That's just who I am. I'll be very interested to see how she handles it to me in person, because it was just a really cowardly way of doing it.
Yes. And if I'm not mistaken, I think it was Bella Abzug, I could be wrong, but who said there's a special place in hell for women who don't support other women. And
that's
it's
right.
True. It's so true. You also, towards the end of the book, you have lessons learned. And I really like this. One of them is be a defender without being defensive. Can you explain a little of what you mean by that?
Yeah, I thought that it was very important to put that chapter in there because I've been around so many people who are never wrong. You know, they have the answer to everything and they're never wrong. So I don't want to ever come across as that person. I mean, I will, if I feel strongly and passionate about something, I will debate it and go to bat for it forever. But I'm not always right. You know, there are times when I have not only been wrong, but I've handled things the wrong way. And I've gotten into some of these Twitter wars with people and whatever other social media platform. I'm usually just on Twitter. And I've allowed myself to go down that sort of deep, dark hole of the things that I don't want to do and taking the battles too far and saying things that I shouldn't have said. And looking back, I'm like, that's not the way that I want to be viewed, or that's not the way that I want someone who doesn't know me to think of me by the words that I write on Twitter. So yeah, I think that I can defend myself. I can defend the book. I can defend the steps that I took with all of this, but I don't have to get defensive and attacking in the language that I use back to these people. When the fight starts getting like that, I get out. So you just kind of have to know what you're in and participate to the point where you can hold your head up high and back out when you think that you'll cross the line, that it won't be the case anymore.
Okay. So one of the last things that you have in the book is a trusted friend asked you if you were worried about being canceled, and you told her that had happened a long time ago. If you're making waves as a woman, there will always be a significant group of people who write you off immediately and do their best to break you emotionally. The truth is, not only am I ready for it, but I welcome it. As Natalie Maine so boldly said in the documentary, Shut Up and Sing, which details the many obstacles the chicks had to overcome after being canceled by country radio, Bring It On. And I think that's what you've ignited in this particular area. It's something, and especially people working in these toxic companies in these toxic areas, we shouldn't have to put up with it. What do you want? I'll ask you a question that everyone asks you. What do you want people to get out of this book? Who do you want to read it?
It's a great question. And I have had this conversation with many people. I've always said that I want I want women who are going through this. And like, that would be 90% of women, 95% of women. I mean, there isn't a woman I've talked to yet who, knowing the story or having read the book, said, I don't get it. I've never experienced that. I haven't met one yet. So if there is one out there, let me know. But if somebody is wavering and saying, like, I'm going through this at work, or I know my good friend's going through this at work and I don't know what to do to help her, I just want it to be an encouraging story that even getting canceled or even going through retaliation isn't a bad thing. I mean, having gone through this, I have learned more than I ever would have learned had I not gone through this. I think that this is the most important thing that I've ever done in my life, is write this book. And part of that is for myself, but part of that is for other women. You know, I don't know if this will be a motivator for women. If it motivates one woman to stand up for herself, then you know what?
That's
then,
huge.
Then I've done my job. And it's not about, you know, I've had people on Twitter, I don't know how they can follow this, that, you know, they criticize the book or they say it's not selling or it's not going to be popular. And my response is, I don't care. I didn't write this book to make money. You don't, it's very difficult to write a book and make money.
That's true.
I wrote this book to get the story out, to sort of free myself and to be able to do it cathartically, but also to put people on notice that there will continue to be people like me out there who are not afraid to speak up, who are not afraid to tell the truth, who are not afraid of retaliation, because living under that blanket and approving that stuff by being silent is so much worse. It really is. I mean, you know, I've had people call me a victim. I'm not a victim. The people who stay are victims. When you speak out and you take it on, you're not a victim. Don't ever call me a victim, because I'm never going to just sit back and take it. I'm going to come out swinging. And, you know, if I'm better for it, or if I win the battle, I mean, it's not really about winning or losing. It's just about me stepping into the ring. And I just want more women to step into the ring and take up for themselves and take up for other women or other people where they see this going on. We saw this case with bullying recently. I mean, 10 years ago, people weren't standing up for kids or other adults getting bullied, but it's become so centralized in the conversation and talked about that now, if you don't stand up for it, there's something wrong with you. That's what I want this to turn into. If you're not sticking up for yourself in terms of discrimination, sexism, harassment, mistreatment of any sort, I want there to be a stigma around being silent. As of right now, the world that we still in, there's kind of this stigma of speaking out. That's why I called the book Troublemaker. It's kind of tongue in cheek in that regard. You know, the minute that you stick up for yourself, for other people, you're called a troublemaker. A lot of folks don't know this. I encourage everyone to read Nelson Mandela's autobiography. His African birth name translates to troublemaker. And I didn't know that until after my book had already gone to print, but it was a pretty cool revelation to learn that. And think about, I mean, Mandela just lived this incredible life, but the heart and soul of his existence was spending 27 years in an apartheid prison fighting simply for what's right. So if that makes you a troublemaker, I think that you should welcome the term.
Bring it on.
Bring it on.
So Lisa, what are you doing now?
I am talking to good folks like you about the book. So thank you for having me on. It's great. Every time I talk to somebody, I get to talk about a little different aspect of the book, which is great. I'm working for the PGA Tour, doing their live play-by-play broadcast on ESPN+, which I mentioned in there. And the PGA Tour live team is one of the groups that I give a shout out in the acknowledgments, because I never thought that I would work in media again, especially sports media. And they didn't care. They didn't care that I spoke out and stood up for myself, because they had worked with me previously. They know who I am. They know my character. They know that this story isn't fabricated. And they care about treating people right. And I will say, working for them has been an absolute pleasure. It's still a male-dominated industry, but they have more women working there than any place I've ever worked in the sports world. They have more people of color working there than I've ever experienced in the sports world. And the people running the ship at PGA Tour Entertainment are just good people. They're good folks. They care about equality. They care about not bringing egos into the workplace. They don't care if you're on air or if you're running camera or doing graphics. They treat everybody the same. So it's just, it's been such a joy to work there and to be able to stay in the business somewhat. I kind of work there on a part-time basis, but to see that good people do exist in this business. It is out there and it's really not that difficult to achieve. You just have to have the right people at the top who simply care.
So one last question. What do you do for fun? What's your favorite thing to do?
Oh boy, that's a good question. My favorite thing to do for fun. I love being outside. I mean, winters here in Florida are great. So I love to be able to go out and cook out, play 9 holes of golf. I can't fully commit to 18 holes anymore. It takes too long. 9 holes of golf, cook out, have a good dinner. I love wine. Everybody calls me Johnny Walker Black because that's my go-to. I'm a Johnny Walker Black girl, but I just, you know, I love to engage in good conversations. A lot of times with people who I don't always agree with, you learn a lot like that. I mean, I'm the person who still likes to talk politics and everybody around me, they're like, no, you can't talk politics. And I'm like, why? I want to talk politics. I don't want to fight about it. I want to learn what's going on and how somebody else thinks about certain topics going on in the world. That was a very long-winded question, answer to your question.
It's but, okay.
I don't have anything specific. I'm just okay. I'm pretty laid back. I just get me outside on a really good day and I'm a happy person.
I like that. Lisa, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. And again, the name of the book is Troublemaker. A memoir of sexism, retaliation, and the fight they didn't see coming. And they did not see you coming. Lisa, again, thank you very much.
Thanks, Sylvia.
Thank you for joining me today. If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested. And if you haven't already, please subscribe.
This has been a Life of Prey production.